Here on Daf Yudal from the base. Omer Rabbi Yehuda Omer Rav. Nidui al tnai tzarech hafor. We know that there's a lot of nidui, which means you put someone into a nidui. That means you're not allowed to be made for him. You can't come within his daladavas. It's kind of mini cherim. It's a low level excommunication. And let's say you put someone into a nidui al tnai with a condition, and that condition was never fulfilled. So you and I would have said, therefore it's void and it doesn't have any meaning to it. It's not valid. Comes over Rabbi Yehuda Rav and he says, even if it's al-tnai, and that tnai never came to pass, it was never fulfilled, nevertheless it needs hafor. Yeah, we're going to see the example right now. The Gemara is going to actually amplify this. But I just want to point out one thing before we go on, that we're going to learn about nidui al-tnai here, from the case of Yehuda in the parasha there of Mechiras Yosef, and to our surprise, that nidui in the case of Yehuda, keep this in mind as we go through the nidui, was not something that was imposed from without. It was actually self-imposed. In other words, Yehuda accepted upon himself a nidui, and with the tzaddik. And despite that, the nidui is valid. He's going to suffer from that nidui, unless there's hafara, unless we can undermine that nidui. And how do we see this? What was the case of Yehuda? The Ksiv. Yehuda made the following declaration to his father Jacob. He said to him, this is when you remember that he was trying to entreat his father to give Binyamin over to him, over to Yehuda, to take him down to the shrine. Im lo ha-viosye lecha, if I don't return him to you, and then the pasuk says, v'tzadkiv lefanecha, and I'll bring him back to you, v'chatasi lecha kol hayom. And Rashi on the top of the page points out the word chet here in this pasuk, v'chatasi lecha, is a language of nidui. Klamar, what this means, is that Yehuda accepted upon himself a nidui. And this nidui, Rashi says in Chumash, he doesn't say it here, is even from Olam Haba. He will be menudah, he will be excluded from all the worlds. Even the next world, the eternal world. If he doesn't return Binyamin. But this was all on the condition that he would not return Binyamin. In fact, he did return Binyamin, and yet we'll see that the nidui is still active, it's still binding, and it needs hafar. And for that, the Gemara quotes a statement of Rav Shmuel in the name of Rav Yonasan. Omer Rav Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Omer Rav Yonasan. Where do we see, and how does this express itself, that this nidui, which was self-imposed by Yehuda on himself, was valid? And the answer is, we see it in the following pasuk. This is at the end of the Torah, when Moshe Rabbeinu is giving out brachos in Bezos HaBracha to each one of the Shvatim. So he says, Yechi Reuven V'al Yomos. Now, who should come next in line after Reuven? Right? Well, Shimon is not there at all. That's a whole other part. Shimon is completely left out of Bezos HaBracha. But Levi should certainly come next. And instead, the very next pasuk after the Bracha is bestowed upon Reuven is Bezos Yehuda. Yehuda is chosen next. So that's what Rashi says on the second line here. Ma ra, why did he, meaning Moshe Rabbeinu, see fit, lismoch Yehuda l'Ruven, some sort of connection here between Yehuda and Ruven. Ma ra l'haskel v'birchas Yehuda b'lashem v'zos ha-ra, v'zos Yehuda. And furthermore, says Rashi, there's another difficulty here, that the language v'zos Yehuda is very strange. It sounds like Moshe Rabbeinu was exerting himself tremendously on behalf of Yehuda to give him a brach of his zos to Yehuda. And then Rashi gives the answer. So we're going to put our finger on the third line of Rashi, keep it there for a moment, and we're going to go back to the statement of Rav Yonasan. It says Rav Yonasan, why did Moshe Rabbeinu put the brach of Yehuda right after the brach to Reuven? And he said, the zos Yehuda.
Is that a hafara? Is that, I mean,
that's, hang on just for two more minutes and hopefully we'll get at least a partial picture of what's going on. He says, Kol osan arvoim shana, shahoy Yisrael b'midbar. Because up until the last day of the last year of 40 years in the desert, when Moshe Rabbeinu gave out the brachas, Yehuda was in a state of nidui. What do I mean? Atzmosa shel Yehuda hayu megulgalim bi'aram. In other words, each one of the Shvatim, after they died, each one individually was placed, the body was placed in an aram, in some sort of a casket. That casket was meant to be brought down to Eretz Canaan. And in the case of every one of the brothers, with the exception of Yehuda, Rashi says, this is the third line from the top, Levisha hayu atzamos kol ha-shvatim shildon kayam. In other words, all the parts of the body were intact. But Shel Yehuda, says Rashi, migul golim. They were completely demarred or detached. There was no integrity, so to speak, to his body. It wasn't hanging together. And apparently, we're going to see later, that this means that Yehuda wasn't ready for burial, and not only that, he wasn't even going to be accepted in the next world, in the world to come. He will be like forever, I don't know, suspended somewhere in this state of Gilgal, of the parts of his body barely hanging there together.
Why didn't you do this while he was alive? You didn't know that this was the case?
Why did he take anything?
Let's say he took the needle. Why didn't he, you know, after he came back with the young, he tried to mop through the net and didn't know he killed it?
Let's ask a different question. Why was the implementation of the Nidui suspended until after his death? In other words, he didn't really suffer the Nidui during his lifetime. The Nidui was more for the world to come, for the posthumous Nidui than during his life.
But he should have mocked him, he should have somehow mowed him while he was alive, knowing that that's
right.
What happened.
I guess there was no one big enough.
He relied upon someone else to do it.
Right, there was no one big enough who could actually do this. Only Moshe Rabbeinu could do this, so you didn't have that opportunity. Moshe was the only one who could bring, you know, rest to Yehuda's body. And what did Moshe say? Moshe says in front of Almighty God, he says, Ribono Shel Olam, let's talk about Yehuda. Yehuda is great, and his greatness is in his impact on his brother Reuven. So the juxtaposition of Reuven and Yehuda is to indicate that Yehuda's greatness, when did he step up to the plate? It was in order to help or impact on Reuven. Why? Mi garam le Reuven sheyodeh. You remember that Reuven was guilty of a sin, a pretty serious violation of Bilbil Yitzuei Avi. And Reuven, again, I'm going to take the moral literally, and then we're going to see that's not what I'm telling you now is not right. But Reuven never confessed his sin. Okay, that's not true, but let's say it just literally translated to tomorrow. When did Reuven finally confess his sin? Yehuda caused him to do that. Why? Because if you remember the sin of Yehuda, the vice of Tamar, Yehuda comes forward and publicly confesses his crime. And he says, with all the humiliation that he brings upon himself, Sodka Mimen. When Reuven sees the courage of Yehuda to make this public declaration of confession, Reuven himself is inspired to come forward and confess his crime. So therefore, the pasuk says, "Vizos liyuda." This is the bracha that Moshe Rabbeinu says, "I want to bestow upon Yehuda." Shma Hashem kol Yehuda, meaning, please listen to the soul, so to speak, of Yehuda that's crying out that he should come to some rest, that his body should be integrated into one whole. And as a result, in the aftermath of Moshe's prayer of the Zos Yehuda, Oil Evare L'Shafar, all the parts, the members of Yehuda's body, reconnected. They went back to their original connection. They were no longer Milgul Golem, if you remember that word. Let's take a break here for a split second. We're in the middle of the story. But all the Mefarshim asked the following question. What do you mean Reuven didn't confess his crime until Yehuda did so? That's not true. The Medrash says that where was Reuven at the moment that they took Yosef and threw him into the bar? He was busy v'sako u'bitanisa, meaning he's wearing sackcloth and he was fasting in order to do penitence for his terrible sin of Bilbil Yitzui Adam. So the answer that's offered by the Mefarshim, and this they quote in, if you look through this Tosis, Mi Garam Yehuda, it says, Tema Davir B'medrish V'yoshav Uven Albor Mehefan Shavim V'yishav Sheyoshav V'taynis Al-Maisav Bila Yeshlam V'mikonkam Lohoda B'radim Al-Maisav Yehuda. The public confession was delayed. It only came later after Yehuda's story with Taman, the very next episode after Machiris Yosef. And I would like to add my own embellishment here, I don't know if I'm correct, but it seems to me that this is strange, because the Rambam says that a person should not publicly confess. Confession is in front of God. But if you read the very next Rambam, there in the second paragraph of the Tshuva, the Rambam writes, "Bamed v'amurim de'averos she'peinon l'mach." If a person violates one of the averos between man and God, that he keeps private. He doesn't confess that publicly. In fact, to confess publicly a crime that you committed against God, that's a violation. That's not acceptable. That's chilasha. But on the other hand, the Rambam says, "In bein adam l'chavero, you not only can you confess publicly." But it's even considered a metaher, a machaper. It's even recommended and laudable to confess publicly. So what I'd like to suggest, based on this Gemara and this Tosus, is that in both cases, Yehuda and Reuven, the sins, could be classified as being adam lechaver. In the case of Yehuda, his bein adam lechaver was that he was going to put Tamar to death, again, not intentionally knowing that she was guiltless, but accusing her of a crime. She came as close as you can to be burnt at the stake as anybody would want to. She probably felt the warmth on her skin. And in the case of Reuven, he was Bilbil Yitzui Aviv. Now that's not so clear, because many months ago, I think it was last Elul, we had a discussion about Kibud Av V'Aim, but that comes under Bein Adam L'Makom or Bein Adam L'Chavero. Ramban seems to classify it under Bein Adam L'Makom because it's the fifth of the Decalogue. But in any event, it certainly has an element of Bein Adam L'Chavero to it, and therefore Reuven was encouraged to confess publicly. What brought Reuven to have the courage to do so? He learned that the paradigm for him, the example for him, was Yehuda. And in that sense, Moshe Rabbeinu came forward and said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it's not enough to tell you that Yehuda did this courageous act, but he also had a great impact on others. So now, is the Nidui removed? Not yet. We're only halfway there. True, the physical body now is intact. Yehuda is no longer Milgulgal. But lo havi koma aili lein lemesifta derekhi. They wouldn't let him in to the mesifta up on high. In other words, the nidui still had the validity of preventing him from entering into the mesifta derekhi. So in this footnote here in mesifta, since we're learning about mesifta, not the Masif de Rakia, but the Masif de Yara, he points out that there's a difference between Olam HaZeh and Olam HaBa with regard to Talmud Torah. The halacha is that in the case, this is based on the Marsha, in the case of a Menuda, although we're not allowed to eat with him, we're not allowed to drink with him, we're not allowed to invite him for business dealings and so forth and so on, however, he says, I'll just quote to you his language, "Be olam hazeh ein tzarich laharchik min amenuda b'inyan limud haTorah." Interesting. That amongst the various activities that are excluded from the purview of the nidui in this world, limud haTorah is excluded. There's no iser nidui with regard to limud haTorah. However, what's nidui in olam haba? The Gemara tells us in Brachos, olam haba ein bo lo achila lo shesia. You know, we're not doing business dealings in olam haba. We're not eating, we're not drinking. It's all study of Torah. That's the Masif of the Rekia. He says that's exactly what Nidui is with regard to Olam HaBa. Nidui in Olam HaBa means that we're not allowed to let you into the Chavura that's studying Torah. and therefore there had to be a hafara to alleviate, to remove the potency of this nigui in order to allow Yehuda entrance into the Masiftah Rekiah. So what did Moshe say? So again, getting back to Vizos HaBracha, in the pasuk Vizos Yehuda, he says, V'el amo t'v'enu, which means, let him into the Yeshiva Shalmala, together with the rest of the nation and all the greats. But, you know what?
Really have horror, or is it,
I guess you call it Hatara. Hatara would be the more precise term. But even so, we're still up to stage three. We haven't really got to all around the plate. Because it's true, they let him take a back seat in the Siftah Derekia. But you know what? When it came to all the discussions in Halacha, you know, the pilpul, all the dialectics, he was left out. He probably didn't even understand what was going on. It was flying above his head. So Moshe Rabbeinu adds another tefillah. He extends his prayer and he says, Yadav Ravla. In other words, he should have the ability to fight the battles of Torah. That's Yadav Ravla. And even then, we're rounding third plate, but we still haven't come home. Lo'avi Yada Lefaruke Kusha. He got to the level where he could argue, he could raise questions and objections, but what he was unable to do was answer the questions. And here Moshe Rabbeinu adds another prayer, this is the final prayer, V'ezer mitzarav tichtihi, and bring him guidance or help or strength to fight the battles against those who would argue against him, those who would raise objections against him, he'd be able to defend himself. So basically, let's summarize what we see from this entire story of Moshe Rabbeinu and his prayers on behalf of Yehuda. Yehuda did not reach a state of menucha. He was not really calm. He was not put in a place of menucha. Why? Because the nidui that he accepted upon himself, al tanai, and that tanai was never fulfilled. And Moshe Rabbeinu had to be made for that nidui in order to reinstate Yehuda. And that's what he does here. Now, if you take a look at Tosas Dibra Maskil Afilu, which is the top Tosas on your page, Tosas says, Yesh l'midakit himikan d'niduyim shalonu afilu osam sheyesh l'mzman ein lindos atzman misofe shariakol histo v'dover shalohoye v'yoto l'kayim. So what is Tosas saying over here? Tosas is saying that what we should learn from this sugya is that you shouldn't put a person into nidui, even on tanai. You say to him, you know what, if you do this, that's fine, but if you don't do this, you'll be in nidui. And Tosas says that maybe we could justify these kinds of niduyim that we say to people, because if you say to a person, I'm going to put you into nidui unless you do so and so, then that tanai is valid. And that's a way of pressuring someone to live up to that promise. Why in this case is the nidui valid, even though it's al tanai? There's something very special Tosa says about this tanai. It was a tanai shelo haya biyado shel Yehuda l'kai. In other words, Yehuda could not really guarantee, on the shadow of a doubt, that he could defeat the power of the viceroy Yosef and bring Binyamin back.
It's a risk factor.
Correct. And therefore, in such a case, the nidui is chal even without the tanai, says Tosfos. If Yosef at the end of the day would have prevented him from bringing Binyamin back, or if Binyamin would have kashon died on the way, or whatever, you know, went near one of the tunnels or something, I don't know. So then he would not be able to fulfill his tanai. Therefore, the nidui is chal despite the tanai, because the tanai itself is not a valid tanai. Tanai has to be valid if it's the yodo l'kayim, if he can fulfill it. But our nidui, that we take a nidui on a person, that if you don't do so and so, if you won't fulfill my request, then you'll be in a nidui. There, the nidui itself from its very inception is dependent upon the tanai. If he doesn't do so, if he doesn't live up to what he could do, it's all biyado, he has the ability, then he's put into nidui. But if he fulfills the tanai, then there's no nidui and we don't need hafara. The only case where we need hafara, according to Tosus, in the case of a nidui tanai, is only when the tanai is eno biyado l'kayim. Such a tanai is not valid. However, the Ritva rejects this Tosfos, and he says the following. I'll read to you the language of the Ritva. He says, "Ein l'damo stam nidui al tnai l'maisa shel Yehud l'fisha b'maisa zeh niskayim atnai b'miktas sharei lo heshiv Yehuda es binyomen al Yaakov ov." So the Ritva claims that the reason why this nidui of Yehuda is activated is not because nidui al tanai tzarech hafara, but nidui al tanai, if the tanai is not fulfilled in its perfect literal sense, it's only partially fulfilled, that's not called the key of a tanai, and that's why the nidui is bound. Why is Yehuda in nidui? Because he never actually brought Binyamin back to his father. What he did was he brought his father back to Binyamin, but Binyamin never actually went to Knan. He stayed in Mitzrayim, and Yaakov was brought down to Mitzrayim. And then the Ritva is mefalpil, is that really only a partial kingdom tonight? Yaakov Avinu himself agreed to go down to Mitzrayim, so maybe that itself is considered a kingdom tonight. He fulfilled his commitment to Yaakov Avinu, and he said, "You know, I have Binyamin for you, just come down." And Yaakov says, "All right, I'm coming down to be reunited with my son Binyamin." Then he says, "He talking." That we should judge a nidui by what we think is in the mindset of the person who took the nidui. Kigon, in bezin menadim adam im lo yifas chovo leplod. Bezin put a person into nidui if he doesn't pay up his debt to so and so. Baholach also adam aritzas ploni. And then he went over to the guy and he said, "Look, I'm really down and out. I don't have the cash. Would you be willing to waive the debt?" And he, in fact, responded in the affirmative. He was willing to waive the debt. Daivakav, in such a case, lo chala nidui me'akash mitchila hoisa daitam came. So he's getting really down into the, you know, slicing it really, really thin. If it's okay with the oil, and we're in the mood for a little bit of agadato, and we're talking about the bones of the Shvatim, Rashi says all the bones were intact, they were brought down to Eretz Canaan, Yehuda was a problem until the 40th year. So I want to share with you, I actually photocopied it for you, I was very optimistic, I made 7 copies, okay, fine. But,
I'll take two.
Yeah. So you just, what do you use? 3 copies, I guess. So I'll save the spare ones. Yeah. So this is a beautiful, I think it's a beautiful shtickle cover that has a lot of deep insight. And to me it's cool of Chiddush of Rav Wolfson, who is, Rav Moshe Wolfson is the Mashgiach of Torah Das Yeshiva in New York. And he speaks about the fact that Yaakov, when he turns to Yosef and begs him, Alma, to grant him Mitzrayim, but bury me down in Ma'aras Machpelah, don't let them bury me in Mitzrayim, he says the following. Yosef's response is, Vayomer, he says, Anochi Ese Kidvarech, which sounds like Yosef, since he had the power to fulfill Yaakov's wish, he was the viceroy of Egypt, he said, you know what, I'll do exactly what you told me. However, the Dask Zakenim, or the Baal Yatosus, has an entirely different interpretation of the words Anochi Asev Kidvarech. Anochi Asev Kidvarech means, I'll do for myself exactly what you wanted to do for yourself. Just like you commanded me to bring your remains from Mitzrayim to Eretz Canaan, I'm going to command my brothers to bring my remains, and their remains too, down to Eretz Canaan, and not be buried in Mitzrayim. So Rav Wolfson points out that the Das HaKenim Baal Yatosan on a simple level is very difficult. Here, a father on his deathbed is asking for the last request, his final request from his son. And all his son can respond is saying, forget about what you asked me. You know what? I'm going to do it for myself. It's almost that Yosef is selfishly interested in burying and having himself, his own remains buried in Eretz Yisrael, without even relating to the request of his father Yosef. That's question number one. In other words, it would have seemed appropriate for Yosef to first say to his father, you know what? I'll do exactly as you want it, which is a simple pshat in the pasuk, but that's not the pshat of the Das Kedem. Secondly, if Yosef wanted to really do what Yaakov was teaching him has to be done, and he was trying to imitate his father, then shouldn't he have asked his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, to bury him in Eretz Yisrael? Just like Yaakov even told his son, Yosef, to do this, Yosef himself should have commanded Ephraim and Manasseh. Right. I'm not sure I understand your question. He does this is right away.
You're saying that when he says mean that he's gonna do it.
I'm just quoting that's Cain and
Bob.
Don't blame me for it.
Right, I don't understand how he can say that. And the very next thing that Yosef does is he has this big parade and they all go to the Marsha of Ella and they bury
but wait a second, Mitch. There's a very profound message here. What Yosef is saying to his father going to that's Cain is that Dad, you're teaching me something that I didn't know. I mean, I'm going to die whenever I die. Yosef was actually the first of the brothers to die. And I'll be buried in Mitzrayim. That's what I thought. I mean, could you imagine what they, you know, today they go to Mitzrayim to see the Sphinx, right? Well, what's it called? They would have had a tremendous manota, what's it called? Mausoleum around Yosef's burial. And he was the vice of Mitzrayim. So Yosef, Yaakov, you taught me something profound. It's very critical that my remains be taken to Eretz Mitzrayim. But is that the proper response? Where's the respect? And secondly, why is he commanding his brothers and not his sons? Okay. Rashi says in Shmos Yud Gimel that Yosef was demanding of his brothers not only that he, Yosef, be brought for burial to Mitzrayim, but they themselves should be commanding their children to be buried in Mitzrayim. So the question now is, why does Yosef have to go a step further and impose this will on his brothers? I mean, that's their problem. You know, they should decide where they want to be buried in the land of Israel. Why does he feel compelled to obligate his brothers to arrange that they be buried in the land of Israel? Anyway, if you have all these questions in the back of your mind, the main thing is the answer, not the questions. You know, sometimes the questions are better than the answer, but here I think the answer is very profound. Rav Wolfson wants to know, why is it important that the bones of a person be taken to Eretz Kanaan? He says the following. The key to understanding Yosef's actions lies in the fact that he specifically asked to take his bones out of Mitzrayim. Why dafka the bones? He says, the body of the righteous, according to Chazal, does not decay, remains fully intact. So why stress take my bones? Why didn't you say take my body? And he wants to build himself on a Gemara Nida that teaches us what does a father give to a child in the birth process? Meaning, you know, you have an embryo that develops in its mother's womb for 9 months until it's born, and the father contributes X, the mother contributes Y, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu contributes Z. So the Gemara says that amongst the contributions of the father is the bones. The mother donates the skin. So you see that the legacy of a father, according to the Gemara Nida, is somehow connected to one's bones. The bones represent, what did I get from my father? And therefore, when a person receives his bones from his father, they are permeated with his father's imprint. You follow what's going on here? Chazal talk about bre kari devu, right? It's something. So he's saying that the bones, that's what the father gives over a bit of himself to the child. That expresses itself in the bones more than any other part. Again, whether you take this literally, biologically, you take it symbolically, it's not relevant to us because it's going to explain why Yosef asks, why Yaakov asks, and then Yosef says that his bones be taken to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, and Gemara in Erevin says that B'no Kari Davua, a son is a continuation of his father. When Yosef hears that Yaakov was concerned that maybe he'll be buried in Egypt, which you remember, of course, Pharaoh was very shocked when Yosef asked that he take his father, Yaakov, back to Eretz Canaan. In his tremendous dedication to his father, his response was, listen, Dad, not only will I make sure that you will not be buried in Mitzrayim, I'm going to fulfill your will, Dad, the Hidur. I'm going to even embellish it, enhance it. I'm going to add another step. You know what? You want your bones in Eretz Yisrael? I'm going to make sure that not only your bones are in Eretz Yisrael, but even the bones of your children will be in Eretz Yisrael. Of all your children. In other words, what Yosef now recognized was that if his bones were extension of the father, then if they were interred, if they were buried in Egypt, then it would be a part of Yaakov's legacy that would be forever disconnected from Eretz Yisrael, from the land of Israel, for all generations. And therefore, Yosef emphasizes to his brothers to bring his bones out of Mitzrayim. Because instead of focusing on his body, he wants to focus on his bones to say that the legacy of Yaakov, which now expresses itself in the bones that Yosef received in his physical structure from his father Jacob, they would also, as the hemshek, as the continuation of Yaakov, be buried in Eretz Canaan. We now begin to understand why Yosef's response to Yaakov was not disrespectful. On the contrary, he's going beyond. It's a heder mitzvah. He's saying, why Yaakov of you, do you want to be buried in Eretz Canaan? You want to have some impact on your offspring for all generations in their land, in the land of your generations, then it makes sense that your children who have your bones, meaning they have your legacy, your imprint, would also be buried in Eretz Canaan. And if that be the case, and we're turning now to page 2, it also makes sense why Yosef would want to guarantee that not only his bones are buried in Eretz Canaan, but also the bones of his brothers. If, to argue from the opposite position, what motivated Yosef was his own well-being, then, as we asked at the outset, why did Yosef instruct his sons to get this mitzvah? And the answer is because this mitzvah was kibud av. The ultimate purpose and goal of getting all the bones of the various shvatim, of all the shvatim buried in Eretz Canaan, would be an expression of fulfillment of kibud av. And therefore, if it's to respect his father, who has the basic fundamental obligation to respect Yaakov? It's not the grandchildren, in this case, Ephraim Menashe, which would have made sense if it was Yosef's own selfish interest that he had in mind. He would ask his children to become their father. But he was doing this as an act of kibud Yaakov, his father. Therefore, he imposed this obligation not on Ephraim Menashe, but rather on all the shvatim. When they, the brothers, would bury Yosef in Eretz Yisrael, that would be a fulfillment of the desire and respect to Father Jacob. It makes sense then that we go to those who are obligated directly in Kibbutz Avraham, not to the grandchildren who may indirectly have a feud towards their grandfather, but that's certainly a secondary feud. And now we can answer, why is it that Yosef insisted that not only his brothers swear that they would make sure that he was buried, but that their bodies would also be transported to Eretz Yisrael? It would be insufficient that he himself, Yosef, would be buried in Israel, if his brothers' bodies would be remained behind in Eretz Mitzrayim, with their bones in Mitzrayim, and then some spark of Yaakov, some imprint and legacy of Yaakov would be left in Eretz Mitzrayim. The complete honor of Yaakov would be to bury all the brothers in Eretz Israel. Yosef had to make sure that no portion either of him nor of any of the brothers would be left in Mitzrayim, and therefore they would all have to be buried in Eretz. And I just found this very, very exciting, very fascinating. We have a copy for you too, John.
Together, and we should say, tradition that all the shvatim are married from one another. We don't have any such tradition.
No, I never heard such. But again, I think the Alma Tikvarei Mitzrayim means that Mitzrayim represents a foreign culture. You know, it's true that Chevron and being buried in Maris Machpelah has layers and layers of deeper meaning. But the main point is that Chevron and Kiryat Arba is an Eretz Yisrael problem. It's not in Mitzrayim. Imagine if, no, I mean, think of it, Mitch. Could you imagine? I'm joking with you, but I'm not joking. Imagine if all of our forefathers, including Yaakov and all the Shvatim, were buried in Mitzrayim. We all have to like flock to Mitzrayim. Again, some people say that's not so terrible. You know, if I want to see where Rav Nachman was buried, so I go to Uman. That's right. So
there's things that we shouldn't go back.
You're right. That could also be part of it too. All right, let's start the Mishnah. The Mishnah. I'm sorry. Yeah, we're not yet ready for the Mishnah. I'm sorry. The previous Mishnah had said, if you recall, that there were three categories of Kohen Gadol, and they all kick in the halacha of freeing the Rotzeach from the Ira Mikra. There was the Kohen Mashiach Melchama. I'm sorry, let's go in order. There was the Kohen Mashiach B'Shem HaMishcha, there was the Kohen Meruba B'Gadim, and it was the Kohen Sha'avar Mimishichusa. Okay, Rabbi Yehuda added a fourth category. Now, if we go back to the Mishnah for a moment, there's a machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos how to learn this. Rashi says that Kohen Gadol Sha'avar Mimishichusa means that there was some psul in the Kohen Gadol, and as a result they had to appoint a second string Kohen Gadol, and then the first original Kohen Gadol now is kosher, right? His psul was removed, so he goes back to his avodah, and a second Kohen, who is the substitute Kohen, the fill-in Kohen, is removed from his status as a Kohen Gadol. He's called Mashuach Sha'avar Mimishichus. Correct. That's the Shita of Rashi. Okay then? The Rambam, for example, has a different shot in the Mishnah, and he says that the Rishon became Tameh, or he became a Baal Mum. Then they appointed someone to replace him. And then during the period of time that he was replaced, the first Kohen, he's called the Kohen Mashuach She'ovar Yimshichus. Okay. So the Gemara asks the following question. He boiled usually means that, you know, somebody threw out his suffer. What's the din in the following case? The Misas Kulam Chosid, do we have to wait till all three of these Kohen and Gedolim die? O Dilma the Misas Echad Mihem, or is it enough that one of the three die? Toshma, the Mishnah says later on, Nigmar Dino, if at the point in which the Gmar Din, you remember that we brought the Rotzeach into Bezdin, and Bezdin hands down a verdict that he's a Rotzeach, so he has to go into Golos. Below Kohen Gadol, at that moment there was no live Kohen Gadol. At some point the Kohen Gadol had died, then it was Gmar Din, but they hadn't yet replaced the Kohen Gadol. It's Ein Yotze Misham Liol. Mr. Shem will be talking about that in just a few minutes in the very next mission. The Yip Esau, if you're going to tell me that the Din is that each one of the three Kohen Gadolim can, with his death, free the Rotzeach Bishogeg from the Ir Miklat. Then let's say there's a Kohen Mashuach B'Shem Ad Mishcha, and he had died, and he wasn't around at the moment of Gemar Din. We had there B'Dahana, but we still have the possibility of waiting for the death of the Kohen Merub of Gadim or the Kohen Shomer Mishichusa. There are two other candidate Kohen and Gadolins, whose death would bring, again, if I say you need all three to die, until all three die, it's not enough, and there's no freedom for the year from the year Mikvah. That makes sense. If one of the Kohanim Gedolim of these three died prior to the Maradim, there is no option for the Rotzeach in any scenario to get out of the year Mikvah. Right? Because one of the three was not appointed, was not alive at the time of the Maradim. But if you'll say that any one of the three are candidates independently for the freedom, then who cares if there was, you know, if one of the three Kohen Gadolim had died at the time before the Maradim, let the Rotzeach go free from the Mikvah with the death of one of the other two Kohen Gadolim. So I'm not sure, Mitch, but I think, is that the next word in the Gemara? That what you just said? Let's read the next word in the Gemara. Vidalek. The Gemara says that the case in the Mishnah, which says that this Rotzeach will never get out of the Miklot because the Kohen Gadol had died, is a case where there weren't any other Kohen Gadol. There was only one Kohen Gadol. Meaning, a Kohen Sha'avar is only in a very specific case, whether it's Rashi's Pshat or the Rambam's Pshat, and what was the other Kohen Gadol? What did I leave out? Sorry. Kohen Sha'avar Mishichuso and Merubu Gadol, right? Because there wasn't any Shevet HaMishka. There were no other Kohen Gadol. So is that more or less what you have in mind? If that's what you have in mind, you can only ask me why the Gemara not think of this in the Havli. You know, it seems like the obvious answer. In other words, I could prove to you that it's enough. I could assume that I need all three to die.
Get it straight. Okay, the Havli meter was that I'm going to prove to you prove to you that all three died. No, really, all you need is one. But there was only one, right? So the Gemara says Bidaleka,
right? Okay, now I get it. So Bidaleka means that Enachinami, if there are three Kohen Gadolim at the time of the Maradin, you need that all three died. Why does the Gemara say that Kohen Gadol died and therefore he can't go out? The answer is there only was one Kohen Gadol.
Okay. When would you ever have three at once, though, if you had?
So that we discussed a few weeks ago. I don't remember all the details. The Rashi says that up until Yoshiyahu HaMelech, every single Kohen Gadol was Nimshach B'Shevet HaMishka, and post Yoshiyahu HaMelech, every single Kohen Gadol was Merubah B'Gadol, and they didn't have Shevet HaMishka. So everybody and their uncle yells at Rashi, if that be the case, how can you assume that you had three Kohen Gadolim serving at the same time? It's physically, historically impossible. So that we had a few weeks ago. I don't remember all the answers I need. So the Mishnah now presents a number of dinim that apply to the freedom of the Rotzeach from the Iram Miklot with the death of the Kohen Gadol. Says the Mishnah, with regard to the Rotzeach B'Shogeg, who is judged by Bezin, U Mishen Nigmar Dino, following the Psak Din that he's hived to go. So he hasn't yet got himself to the Yermik. It's the very moment after his Gmar Din, right? The judge, you know, slams down the gravel and says you have to go to the Yermik. But immediately afterwards, talking to the Deeper Mesak, or Jodal, the Kongo dies, Hareza ain't a Gola. He's completely absolved of any obligation to go into the Yermiklah. He's a free man because he was lucky. He never had to get himself to the Yermiklah. The Kohen Gadol died after the Gemara Din. On the other hand, Achelo Nigmar Dino, this is what we discussed just a few minutes ago, if the Kohen Gadol died before the Gemara Din, Mesa Kohen Gadol, Uminu Acher Tachtov, but they appointed a Kohen Gadol to replace the one that died. So if this replacement, the new appointment, took place before the Gemar Din, Uli Acha Mikan Nigmar Dino, Okay, so we have time T1, T2, and T3. At time T1, the judgment is going on, and the Kohen Gadol dies. At time T2, the Kohen Gadol, the new live Kohen Gadol, is appointed to replace the late Kohen Gadol. And at time T3, it was Madin that he has to go into Golos. In that case, Chosev Nivimisasa Shoshem. So then, since there already was a Kohen Gadol at the time of the Gmar Din, therefore, he, the Rotzeach, will be freed with the death of that Kohen Gadol who was alive and well at the time of the Gmar Din. But what happens if the Gmar Din took place before they were able to appoint the second Kohen Gadol? Nigmar Dino below Kohen Gadol is, and I'm skipping a little bit, Eina Yotze Misham Li'ol. In other words, if the Gmar Din took place and there was no Kohen Gadol at that time, the Kohen Gadol already died and wasn't replaced, then no matter what happens later after the Gmar Din, no matter who will be appointed as a Kohen Gadol, and no doubt they will appoint a Kohen Gadol, it doesn't matter. That Kohen Gadol has nothing to do with this Rotzeach, because you have to have the Kohen Gadol who was the Kohen Gadol at the moment of the Gmar Din. Okay, I skipped a few cases which we'll fill in just a minute. So now, what's the reason why everything hinges on Gmar Din? Why, you know, we spoke about the fact that the Kohen Gadol's death is a result of some level of responsibility of guilt because he didn't pray on behalf of the people of Israel to prevent this tragedy from happening. But it's a little bit odd in the case that you appoint a Kohen Gadol at, you know, just one moment before the Gmar Din, and a minute later, after the Gmar Din, this Kohen Gadol dies. I mean, what's his level of responsibility with regard to this Ritzicha? You follow my question? The Ritzicha happened. It took a while until we got him into judgment, into Beis Din. I'm just anticipating the next Gemara, so you'll enjoy it and you'll appreciate the next piece of Gemara. We took a while until we judged him in court. At the time that we judged him in court, this Kohen Gadol didn't exist. But right before the final verdict, we appointed the Kohen Gadol. A minute after that verdict was handed down, the Kohen Gadol drops dead. So why is that Kohen Gadol guilty? And that's what the Gemara is going to talk about in just a minute. But there was something else that I wanted to talk to you about, which I can't remember right now what it was. Let me just see. Oh yeah, the Tosfos Yontif. You know that one of the super commentaries on Mishnah is the Tosfos Yontif. And he says the following. He has the following insight. He says that, as we'll soon see, Haya Olav, meaning that Kohen Gadol that was appointed before the Gmar Din, Levakish Rachamim, to ask God, She Yigmar Dino Lischus. Okay, we'll talk about this in just a minute. Hang on. He says the following. Perhaps we can find some element of guilt on the part of the Kohen Gadol who was appointed right before the Gmar Din. He was the Kohen Gadol at the time of the Gmar Din. Okay, and we'll see about what guilt, what, how he could have prevented the goals of the Rotzeach Hashoah. But says the Tosfos Yontif, take a look at the next case, which we skipped, let's go back. And he says, there I can't understand what's going on. He says, and the Mishnah says, Nigmar Dino, below Kohen Gadol, that's number one. Vehahoreg Kohen Gadol. A person kills a Kohen Gadol. And this Kohen Gadol is replaced by another Kohen Gadol. The murder was obviously the Shogeg. And the Mishnah says, Ein Yotze Misham Li'ol. I mean, if you're telling me that a Kohen Gadol can replace the original Kohen Gadol if at the time of Gmar Din he's appointed, and therefore he's guilty in some sense. So if a person inadvertently kills the Kohen Gadol, and then that Kohen Gadol was replaced before the Gemara Din, why is the Mishnah saying the Yotzei Mishom Liolam? The second Kohen Gadol was in office at the time of the Gemara Din. He's therefore bears the guilt. Then the Mishnah has another case. The Kohen Gadol Shahar. If a Kohen Gadol kills someone b'shogeg, he ain't Yotzei Mishom Liolam. Why not? Says the Tosfos Yontif, Hahore Kohen Gadol, the Kohen Gadol Shahara, and Yotzei Mishom Liolam lo nisbar taima. Because of Alkach Rashi, the Masechta Sanhedrin, Tama Dover, who Mishom She'en Kan Kohen Gadol Hamashamish B'Migdash B'Shas Gemar Din. In other words, Rashi and Sanhedrin identifies these two cases with the first case. It's Nigmar Dino below Kohen Gadol. So then it comes out that according to Rashi, if let's say the Kohen Gadol was replaced by another Kohen, because the first Kohen Gadol was murdered, then it wouldn't be Nigmar Dino below Kohen Gadol. Well, let's say the Kohen Gadol is self-murdered, but now he's replaced by another Kohen Gadol at the time of his murder. Then Eino Kinami, he would go out free with the death of that Kohen Gadol. In other words, what I'm looking for here, and I'm not finding it, is someone who would say that this kind of Ritzicha, meaning when you murder the Kohen Gadol himself, or in the case of Kohen Gadol where he committed murder, that would be too severe to allow freedom from the Yermikla. In other words, the Avera is more severe than any other kind of receiver. And therefore, he would not be Yotze Misham Yol. So for this, I look at the Ritva, and the Ritva says the following. Why does the Gemara explain why it is that, but why does the Gemara limit and circumscribe this case to a case where they didn't replace the Kohen Gadol before the Gemara did? And secondly, says the Ritva, Din Zekhar Lomdim Anami Masha Omra Mishnah Nigmar Dino below Kohen Gadol. If Rashi is correct in Sanhedrin, that basically in the case where the Kohen Gadol committed murder, or if the Kohen Gadol was killed, there was no Kohen Gadol at the time of the Gemara Din, then the Mishnah is not adding anything. It's just simply repeating the previous case of Nigmar Dino below Kohen Gadol. Therefore, the Ritva says the following: Afal Gav Sheminu Kohen Gadol Asher Kohen Gemar Dino. Even though a replacement Kohen Gadol was appointed, a Yotze Misham Liolam May Acher Vigzeres Hakosati She'ein Misas Kohen Gadol Mo'ila LaHashiv Mi'ir Miklat Ela Biofen She'ein Kohen Gadol Atzmo Hore. O Eina Kohen Gadol Atzmo Nera. V'itachin, very rare that you see a Rishon who says Itachin, he's not sure it's right. Shetam Adover, what's the reason for this Gzeres HaKosu? Mishum Shahore Kohen Gadol, O Kohen Gadol Shaharad, Chamur Ha'avon Ad Mi'od, V'eino Mitzkaper B'Misas Kohen. So it comes out that we have a fundamental machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos. Excuse me, between Rashi and Ritva. Rashi not here, but in the Masechta Sanhedrin maintains that even in the case where the Kohen Gadol was murdered, or the Kohen Gadol committed murder, he would be able to go free if there was a replacement Kohen Gadol at the moment of the Gemar Din. In that case, you don't know why the Mishnah bothered even mentioning these things. Or if we take the Ritva's approach, we can now classify the Ritzicha B'Shogeg into two different classifications. What's going on? Okay. So one classification is your standard kind of Ritzicha B'Shogeg, and that lends itself to Yitzimah being the Ir Miklat. And then there's a more severe case of Ritzicha B'Shogeg where there's not even a possibility of being Yotze B'Misas, B'Misas Kongo. Then we get to the next case in the Mishnah. V'ayyotze, you remember we discussed this, v'ayyotze lo li'edus mitzvah. For example, Rashi gives the example, he has to testify in Yerushalayim on Kiddush HaLevana, v'lo li'edus mamon. That's the Mishnah said is lo zu'afsu, even edus mamon, where somebody can lose a massive amount of money, and it's an absolute mitzvah of imlo yagid v'nos avonu, meaning testimony in a monetary case is not a matter of voluntary option, but rather it's a halakhic requirement, it's a mitzvah, and if you don't testify, you violate in favor of imlo yagid, and nevertheless he doesn't go out of the pickle for that testimony. And even the low litzarech Edus nefashos, even in the case of a life and death decision, he doesn't leave the Irvik.
Let someone die.
Let someone die.
Correct. No exceptions.
No exceptions. So how can this be? So the Teferes Yisroel, which is another super commentary on Mishnah, asks the following question. What do you mean? He doesn't go out with Tzorek Nefashos. Hooray! We have a principle in Gemara Yuma, Ein Lecha Dover Momen Lifnei Pikuach Nefesh. Again, this is a big three, but not for the sake of the mitzvah of living in the Ir Mikvah. He says, if you violate a mitzvah of the Torah for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh, not only are you allowed to do so, but you're required to do so. He says, Ketzad Yitokhi, how could it be that because of the mitzvah that's incumbent on the Rotzeach to sit and dwell in the Ir Mikvah, he doesn't go out, Lahatzil Nefashos? And he says, he's not willing to say that what the Mishnah means is that he's allowed to go out, but he's not obligated to go out. And the reason he's not obligated to go out, he says, Asher mutal olos is mikomakom yeh rashoi go adam lahargo. He's not even willing to say that, because he says, well, maybe he'll defend himself against the go adam. So you might have argued that he doesn't have to put his life into danger for the sake of saving someone else's life, but the Teferes Yisroel is unwilling to say that, because he is of the opinion, this is based on a famous Beis Yosef, that Chayav Adam, a person has to put himself into a Safek danger in order to save someone else from a Vadai danger. And not only that, why wouldn't the people of Israel guarantee some sort of witness protection plan, he says, to prevent the Gol Adam from killing him? He's coming out to be Matzal Nefashos.
I would do that in the original case. When he runs the evidence at first, and the trial comes, they take him to court. You say, how can you take him to court for a trial? Just the Gol Adam, you get him on the way.
So your point is what? That we always if have this normal vulnerability.
It's normal standard procedure to take somebody from the Yerevan blood to appear in court. There's no trial.
Yeah, but that's before you establish that he's got the privilege of enjoying the protection of the Yerevan blood. After
he's running there because he knows he's going to run there even before trial.
But maybe he's actually guilty of murder and not
whatever it is, there's a procedure to take him physically from the vehicle in which he's running to the trial so they can determine what his status is. So why can't you say
that's he's guilty of that because he killed somebody.
Yeah, but if we have the procedure to take him, we don't say,
that's his problem. He's got to defend himself against the Gol Adam. He killed someone. The Torah says that your life is worthless right now. But in the case where he's already in the Ir Miklat, he now has rights to stay in the Ir Miklat. Says the person in Israel, okay, we can grant him those rights. And we can say, okay, we're not comfortable with your exposing yourself to vulnerability, but you have to do that for the sake of Atzolus Nefashos. That's your obligation. Why is it different than any case of a person who's required to expose himself to danger for the sake of saving someone else? And guess what answer the Teferes Yisroel gives? No answer whatsoever. He has no answer to this problem. He doesn't understand how this could be. Meaning, if I were to rewrite the text of the Teferes Yisroel, the Teferes Yisroel basically is proving from this Mishnah that a person does not have to put himself into jeopardy for the sake of saving someone else's life. That's not going to make the Teferes Yisroel happy, because he maintains based on a Beis Yosef, that you have to, you're required to put your life into danger to save someone else's life. So I got to jump into the water, even though I might be carried out by some undercurrent, for the sake of saving you, because you're going under. And I'm not sure that that's the way we're going to posit. In fact, I would quote this Mishnah as a proof against the assumption of the Beis Yosef and the Tiferes Yisrael. But how will the Tiferes Yisrael and the Beis Yosef maintain some sort of explanation, justification for any Yotzeh Misham Liolam, Afilu Liavis Nefashos, to save someone? If you want to dramatize the question, you can read the next few words in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Afilu Yisrael Tzrichimun. The entire community of Israel needs this Rotzeach. He's got one talent that will save the entire community of Israel. Afilu Sartzol Yisrael. He's the only one who can command the forces. Ki Yoav Ben Tzruya. And Yotze Mishom Liola. It's a pellet. You know, you want to tell me that your life, your blood is redder than his, I don't have to expose myself. But you're talking about all of Klal Yisrael are at stake. I mean, how far are you going with this? And the Mishnah quotes a pasuk. I don't know if that's a half in chama, but you know, the pasuk also has to be understood within the context of all the rules that govern halacha. You can't undermine the yisori halacha. Shenema, the pasuk says, El ir miklato asher nas shama, and the extra word shama is sham tehei diraso, sham tehei misaso, sham tehei kfuraso. That's where he's going to live. That's where he's going to die, and that's where he's going to be buried. An unbelievable chiddush. It means if he dies before the Kohen Gadol dies, you have to bury him near Miklat. He can't transfer his remains back to his local cemetery in his local town. Again, we can move his bones after the Kohen Gadol dies, but not earlier. So since the pasuk adds Sham Tehei Misaso, it means his entire life until he dies, he has to remain in the Yer Mikla.
Yeah.
And he can't be removed from the Yer Mikla. So on this question of why the Rotzeach doesn't leave the Yer Mikla, even for the sake of Klal Yisrael, I have a page, but I don't think I have it with me now. Maybe we know, I'll get it to you next time. That summarizes the approach of some of the later achronim on this issue. In anything, one thing is crystal clear here. That if the Rotzeach leaves the Yer Miklat, he is vulnerable to be killed by the Golan. So let's just finish up the Mishnah, we'll call it a night, because there are many different ways of understanding the situation of the Golan when and if and when the Rotzeach leaves the confines of the Yer Miklat. First of all, what are the confines of the Yer Miklat? So the Mishnah says, Kishem Sha'ir Koledes, just like the city itself has the power of protection, Kach Tchuma. Tchuma means a circle around the city, which is called the Tchum Ha'ir, it's usually about Alpayim Am. That also, as an extension of the city, has the power of Klita. And therefore, if the Rotzeach enters into the circle, the radius around, no, not the radius, what's called the circumference, I guess, around that circles the city of a radius of Alpayim Amo, the Gol Adam cannot put him to death. Now, neither the Gemara or the Rishonim explain where we know this from. What is the source? I mean, usually the Gemara would ask, Minol. But somehow, there's got to be a source for it. And it's mind-boggling to me that the Aruch Laner, who lived in the 19th century, came up with a source for this, or so he claims. And it's his own original idea. He says, if you read the pasuk carefully, it says, V'yashav ba, and he shall sit in it. Okay, that's one pasuk. So he says that if the Torah says ba, it means he has to sit in the city. And that's exactly where he has to live his life until the Mises Kohen Gadol, in the city itself. But he says there's another pasuk. And the pasuk says, Gvul ir miklat. In Yatzah Yetzeh Arotzeh says, Gvul ir miklat. So the Aruch HaNer says, well, what's the extra word Gvul? And he insists that the extra word Gvul is coming to teach us the tchum around the city. And although, as far as living in the city, he has to live in the city per se, because it says V'yashabba, but as far as running to the city to protect himself from going down, the halach of Gvul HaYir is formulated by the Torah, and that includes the tchum of the city. And finally, the machlokas between Rabbi Yosef Zudi and the Rekiva, and here we'll call it a night. Rotzeach Shiyotza puts the tchum. Rotzeach left the tchum of the Amiklot, Umitzov Gol Adam, and the Gol Adam finds him, or somebody else finds him and kills him. Is Rabbi Yosef Zudi over Mitzvah Biyad Gol Adam? The Rotzeach had no right to leave the Amiklot. If he does so, the command is imposed on the Rotzeach to put him to death. Anyone else other than the Rotzeach is not obligated to kill him, but he has permission to kill him. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Rishus Biyad Gol Adam. That the Gol Adam is allowed to kill him, he's not obligated to kill him. V'chol Adam Chayovim Olav, anyone else who kills him will be killed. He doesn't have the right of the Gol Adam. That's uniquely given to the Gol Adam. Okay then, so we'll stop here and we'll pick this up next time. I don't know when you want to reconvene. Next Wednesday is the day after Tisha B'Av, so you'll let me know if you're free.